Morning. My name is Jamie, and that's the end of my small talk. So generally in life, we move facing forward, dealing with the challenges and opportunities that lie ahead, maybe even doing some planning. But every now and then, we might turn around to see where we have come from and how we got to where we are. And sometimes that can be quite surprising to look back and think, well, I was there and now I'm here. How did that happen? And you can identify those little turning points and changes that happened along the way that resulted in you ending up where you are. And I want to give you some extreme examples of this kind of a thing. Oh. So I was going to make you guess who the guy on the left is, but he's the guy on the right, just from an earlier time. So our Prime Minister was a young man raised by a single mum with debilitating rheumatoid arthritis in the inner western suburbs of Sydney. And now, some 40 years later, he's the Prime Minister of Australia. And I wonder if he looks back and goes, if I could see that young man, would he ever have expected to end up as the Prime Minister of Australia? I've got another example, which will probably... So the little girl on the left is Taylor Swift as a little girl. And she's a bit of a loner at school, didn't really fit in. But she liked music, she liked singing. And she wanted to have that as her career. And then 2 weeks ago, she was at the MCG packing it out for 3 nights in a row with 96,000 people each night. And I wonder if she looks back and thinks to that little girl and think, yeah, it's amazing that that has happened, that that has been my journey. But the person I'm particularly thinking about today, perhaps going through that experience, is the disciple Peter. And I'm going to spend some time in the book of 1 Peter today. So if you want to turn there in your Bibles or apps, we're going to be really concentrating on the verse that Gosha has already introduced to us in the children's story. Peter was somebody who was born and bred to be a fisherman. But at the time of writing this letter that we know as 1 Peter, he'd been an apostle for Jesus for at least 30 years. And it was a long time since he'd lived in Galilee where he grew up. And in fact, he's probably now residing in Rome when this letter is written, from the context of the letter. And like a lot of letters in the New Testament, after the initial greeting that he writes there, he bangs straight into doctrine, which you'll see if you have it open. So he makes these points about God has given us a new birth, and we see this in the resurrection of Jesus, and there's a promise of the inheritance we have ahead of us in heaven. And in the meantime, we will have trials and problems, which help to refine and purify our faith. But then when you get to verse 8, it's almost like he interrupts his doctrinal dissertation to say this key verse. You have not seen him, but you love him. You do not see him now, but you believe in him. And so you rejoice with an indescribable and glorious joy. It's like he's just really struck by this situation, that he's writing from Rome. And who's he writing to? He's actually writing to people who live in what we would now call Turkey. It lists at the start of the chapter there, Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia and Bithynia, which... Anyway, so that's a new map with an old map superimposed upon it. So up here we have Rome, which is where Peter is probably at this point when he's writing his letter. Down here, next to me, is Jerusalem, which is where a lot of all this started. And the people he is writing to are in this part of the world, in Turkey, particularly places like Cappadocia, Bithynia, Pontus. This part of this area is just known as Asia. So there's kind of a dispersal of what's going on there. And the first point he's making is, you have not seen Jesus, but you love him. And there's a connection here, almost an echo of something that happened some 30 years earlier, way back in Galilee. One of the things that Peter is well known for is for denying Jesus 3 times before the rooster crowed on the day of the crucifixion, despite this being the very thing that Jesus predicted he would do and he said he would never do. So Peter had that experience of utter failure. Despite professing his undying loyalty to Jesus, he denied knowing him three times. Denied his friend, denied his Lord. And then, straight after that, Jesus goes to the cross and he dies. Now that's a heavy burden for Peter to carry. And it's a sequence of events to invoke abject misery, really. But of course, Jesus doesn't stay dead. He rises from the grave and he appears to the disciples several times, including once while they're out fishing on the Sea of Galilee, and they end up having breakfast with Jesus. And Jesus makes the time and the effort to speak one-on-one with Jesus in John 21. I won't go through the whole passage, but you'll get the idea. So when they'd finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these do?" Peter replied, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you." Jesus told him, "Feed my lambs." Then again, Jesus says, "Do you love me?" Peter says, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus again says, "Do you love me?" Peter says, a little bit exasperated, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." So after rejecting or denying Jesus three times, he gets face to face to say to Jesus that he loves him. And each time Jesus instructs Peter, "Feed my lambs, take care of my sheep, feed my sheep." So Jesus reinstates Peter and instructs him what he'll be doing. He's never going back to fishing. He's going to be a shepherd of people from then on. He's going to spiritually feed and take care of people. And so his life of ministry begins and continues for several decades, during which time he travels and, as I said, probably wound up in Rome. And he could look back on his own experience. He knew Jesus. He walked and talked with Jesus. He saw the miracles. He heard the parables, the teachings. He saw the care he had for hundreds of afflicted people. And he was part of the inner core, the inner circle of Jesus' relationships. There was clearly a great friendship between the two of them. In fact, he's the only person I can think of, and I'm willing to be corrected on this, who got to say to Jesus, "I love you." And he said it three times. So here's Peter writing this letter, taking stock of this situation. He's now in Rome, and he's writing to people in Asia Minor or Turkey, thousands of kilometres away from Galilee and Jerusalem. And he's obviously struck by the fact that these people never met Jesus, never heard him speak, never spent time with him, never even saw him. But they love him. And he could think to himself, "Well, I know why I love him, because I spent time with him face to face." But how do these people love him? Why do these people love Jesus? It's kind of miraculous that these people in these churches in Asia Minor, that they should experience this great affection and devotion to Jesus. So how does that happen? And a big part of that answer is that the core of the Christian message is attractive. It appeals to the heart. It inspires a love response. Even in our post-Christian culture, we still understand this. Our culture still understands this to some degree. You might say, why do I say that? Because our society no longer holds pretty much anything sacred. But there are some things we still, as a community, as a culture, generally speaking, still hold sacred. And if you travel to the centre of our city in the 1960s, that's what the Shrine of Remembrance setup used to look like. You go down St Kilda Road and you can see the shrine up on the hill there. It looks a bit, well, that's a more modern picture of the Shrine of Remembrance. And inside the main sanctuary, there's a little tablet down on the floor, which you can see the light shining down on. And on that is written, "Greater love hath no man." It's a place of great solemnity and seriousness that even our post-Christian culture still references and reveres. And it's, of course, it's a Bible reference to John 15:13, which are the words of Jesus, who said, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." Even our culture recognises this as the ultimate gesture of love. And this is the central theme of the Christian message. Jesus, the Son of God, loves us so much that he's prepared to lay down his life for us. Now, clearly, not everyone believes that, or understands it or accepts it. But if you do, how can that idea not appeal to your heart? How can that not generate love for him, even if you haven't seen him? Knowing that this is how he views us as worth dying for, I would argue that even the non-believer should want this to be true, that the God who made us loves us enough to die for us. So that's the first part of Peter's verse here. You have not seen him, but you love him. And then he goes on, you do not see him now, but you believe in him. Now when he says believe, this is more than just do you believe he was a real person or not. The word for believe, well, it's believe in. The implication there of you have confidence in Jesus, you have trust in Jesus. You consider the Christian message as a sound basis on which to build your life. Now again, it seems Peter is struck by this contrast between himself and these people that he is writing to. Peter had every reason to trust in Jesus, to have confidence in Jesus. He'd had years of day-to-day living with him, and he saw how Jesus could handle every and any situation. People would come to him with needs and problems. Jesus could help them and he could heal them. People would come to him and listen to his teaching, and all of them were struck by the depth of his wisdom and understanding. Other people would come to him to attack him and denigrate him, and Jesus would challenge them. He would question them. He would mock them. He would make their heads spin and make them so unsure of their own position that they would be too afraid to challenge him again. But instead they plotted to kill him. And even then, he used that for his good purpose. So if ever a person showed that he knew what he was doing in life, Peter knew it was Jesus. I was thinking about the leaders that we have in the world today, how they contrast with that. Inevitably, any leader that we have shows their human frailty and their hypocrisy. I didn't want to get into current politics, but I wanted to give you an illustration. I don't know if anybody saw the Napoleon movie that came out recently. It's a fairly grim kind of an affair. But Napoleon, he was a military genius who won dozens of battles across Europe, probably more than any general in history. But was he always a leader that was worth following? Well, when he took on Russia, yeah, probably not. In a disastrous campaign, he went in with 600,000 soldiers to conquer Russia. And he left with less than half that in defeat and disarray, and with Napoleon himself going off into exile. But then he kind of got bored with exile, and so he escaped, and the French army was sent out to intercept him and to stop him. And so they stop him on the road there, and here he is marching along, trying to make his way back to Paris, and they're supposed to stop him. And he says to them, apparently according to history, "Here I am, kill your emperor if you wish." And they replied, "Long live the emperor," and they join him. Which is bizarre when you think about it, because it was his overweening pride and ambition that caused the pointless deaths of hundreds of thousands of their fellow soldiers, probably their friends. And still, they're prepared to believe in him? What a dubious leader to believe in and trust. Well, that was never the case with Jesus. As I say, if ever a person showed that he knew what he was doing, it was Jesus. The reality is, we all build our lives on something. And Peter knew that he could have the confidence and the trust in building his life on Jesus. But then again, he thinks of these people in Cappadocia and the other places, and he says to them, "You do not see him now, but you believe in him." You believe in him, you trust in him, you're building your lives on him too. So in a way, he's acknowledging, just in this little verse, he's acknowledging that Jesus appeals to both head and heart. You have not seen him, but you love him. That's a heart response. You do not see him, but you believe in him. That's a head response. But how did that happen? How did they come to the point of deciding to trust in Jesus, these people who live so far from where Jesus was, and it's now some 30 years later? Well, it's hard to give a small answer to that, so I'll give us a slightly big answer. How did this come about? Well, it actually came about through Peter, really. If you read the book of Acts, on the day of Pentecost. This is some 40 days after Jesus was resurrected and went back to heaven. There's this occasion where... Oh, let me read it. And I've skipped a few verses out here, so you can read that for yourself in context. When the day of Pentecost had come, they were all together in one place, the disciples. All of them were filled with the Holy Spirit, and they began to speak in languages as the Spirit enabled them. Now there were devout Jews from every nation under heaven residing in Jerusalem. When this sound occurred, a crowd gathered and was in confusion. Parthians, Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus and the province of Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and so on. So at this occasion, there's God-fearing devout Jews from all manner of places that come together in Jerusalem, and they heard Peter speak to them about Jesus. Now, it's a lengthy kind of sermon, so I'm going to have to summarise it a little bit. But he made two big points to these people that would appeal to their heads, to their thinking. First thing he did was he connected Jesus to the scriptures that they already knew very well, what we would call the Old Testament. And because they were devout, God-fearing Jews, they would know these words. So Peter is saying that, well, Jesus didn't just come out of nowhere as some random kind of event. He was expected, he was foretold, and he's the embodiment of what is written in the scriptures they already knew. And that's a strong appeal because it connects Jesus to the knowledge they already had in their heads and in their religious life. Okay, you already understand this much and you believe this much. Okay, well, that bit points to Jesus, and this bit points to Jesus, and this bit points to Jesus, and this bit points to... He could have picked anywhere in the Old Testament almost and built a bridge to Jesus for these people. To borrow from Tim Keller, Jesus is the true and better Adam who passed the test in the garden and whose obedience is imputed to us. Jesus is the true and better Joseph who at the right hand of the king forgives those who betrayed him and sold him and uses his new power to save them. Jesus is the true and better Moses who stands in the gap between the people and the Lord and who mediates a new covenant. Jesus is the true and better David whose victory becomes his people's victory, though they never lifted a stone to accomplish it themselves. Jesus is the true and better Esther, who didn't risk leaving an earthly palace, but lost the ultimate and heavenly one, who didn't risk his life, but gave his life to save his people. Jesus is the real Passover lamb, innocent, perfect, helpless, slain, so the angel of death will pass over us. He's the true temple, the true prophet, the true priest, the true king, the true sacrifice, the true lamb, the true light, and the true bread. And you could summarise all that by saying what Jesus did in John 5:39. You study the scriptures diligently because you think that in them you have eternal life. And it is these same scriptures that testify about me. Now that's something to believe in. So for those Jews that anchored their thoughts right into something they already knew. But secondly, he coupled that with an account of what had just happened to Jesus only a few weeks before this moment. He was handed over and put to death, but he didn't stay dead. God raised him. And he compares that to David. Again, somebody they knew, they were very familiar with and great respecters of. David died and was buried, and Peter says, well, his tomb is still here. Jesus died, he was buried, and his tomb is empty. And if they wanted to, they could walk a short distance and see that empty tomb for themselves. And I think many of them would have done that. So there was something physical, something tangible they could experience with their own eyes and engage with their minds. Does an empty tomb 100% prove that Jesus rose from the dead? No. But it does need to be explained. Did you ever wonder why Jesus died a criminal's death but received a wealthy man's burial? Generally, if you're crucified, your body was just thrown in a pit. But Jesus was buried in a rich man's tomb. Why? Well, part of it was for this very reason. So the people at that time could visit and see and wonder and think about what it meant that his place of burial was now empty. So he engages the mind at two points. He builds on the scriptures they already knew and they're already devoted to. And he points to a physical reality that they could see and experience and think about. And then these devout, God-fearing Jews, they went home to Cappadocia and Asia and so on, armed with this life-changing information, and they told people. They engaged with others, and churches started in these regions. And as far as I can work out, there's no indication that Paul or any of the other apostles, including Peter, even went to places like Cappadocia. But there were churches there because Peter was writing to them 30 years after the day of Pentecost. So churches bloomed through that period of time. And as I said, he seems very struck by this fact. They haven't seen Jesus, but they love him. He's appealed to their hearts. They believe in him. They trust him. He's appealed to their minds. And because of that, so you rejoice with an indescribable and glorious joy because you're attaining the goal of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Now, when Peter wrote that, probably in the 1860s, Christianity had just become a forbidden religion. So to be a Christian was now a criminal act, which meant there were waves of oppression and persecution now washing across the Roman Empire. And Peter alludes to this a little bit earlier in this letter when he says, "This brings you great joy, although you may have to suffer for a short time in various trials." He almost kind of skims over that, but it's actually quite a weighty verse. To be a Christian at this time meant strife. Most of us can't really relate to how that would feel, to say, "I'm going to defy the government and risk persecution or imprisonment in order to be true to our faith." That's unfamiliar territory. And Peter is not just talking about surviving and hanging on. He's talking about rejoicing with an indescribable and glorious joy in spite of the difficulties and the dangers. Sometimes when I'm boating on the Gippsland Lakes, the weather can go quite nasty. If the wind is strong enough and the waves are big enough, it can be quite challenging. And if something goes wrong with the boat, you'd be at the mercy of the elements and you'd be in trouble. You'd have no control over what happened to you. You'd be buffeted and beaten and taken where you didn't want to go. It'd be quite dangerous. And in those circumstances, it'd be good to be able to drop an anchor so at least you could hold your ground. And Jesus is like that anchor. He enables us to hold ground in the face of difficult conditions. But thinking about it, and having been on the lakes in bad conditions a few times recently, Jesus is really more than just an anchor. Jesus is like having a motor and a rudder, because when you have power and you have direction, in spite of the conditions, you can still make progress in the direction you want to go. May not be easy, but you can still do it. So the message of Jesus is powerful and life-enriching to the extent that it could counterbalance the bad stuff. And not even counterbalance, that sort of implies that it just evens it out. It actually outweighs the negatives that existed for these people at this time to enable that joy to win through. They still had the grief and the trials and the strife, but they also had the joy. And it was a striking thing, and it was a true thing, because for all the attempts by the Roman Empire throughout this period of time to oppress or persecute Christians, did it stop the growth of the church? No, it didn't. It kept going against one of the most powerful empires the world has ever seen. So there was a positivity at the heart of the Christian message that drove it forward, despite the heavy weather beating against it. And for Peter, he says that the driver of this joy is that these people are attaining the goal of their faith, the salvation of their souls. So what are they getting out of this? Salvation, rescue, deliverance, yes. But for Peter, I do wonder if that means something more as well. Is it possible that he's looking forward to that future time when Jesus returns and sin and death are no more, trouble and strife cease, and they see him face to face? In some senses, the goal of salvation for Peter was just to be with Jesus once more. Here is a man who is closer to Jesus than anyone, who would have enjoyed every waking moment he got to spend with Jesus, who loved him, who lived through the grief of his death, and then for a brief time got to see him again. I can't help thinking that the goal of salvation was not so much what would happen to himself in terms of no more sin, no more perishable body, being made new, but just getting to be with Jesus again and forevermore. Now, why have I told you all this about Peter's interest in these people and their experience of Jesus in Cappadocia and the like? I tell you all this because this is you. If you are here or you're watching online and you're a Christian, you have not seen him, but you love him. You do not see him now, but you believe in him. And like those Cappadocians and others, you are separated in time and in distance from when and where Jesus walked the earth. They were about 1,000 kilometres from Jerusalem, and it was about 30 years later. You are about 13,000 kilometres from Jerusalem, and it's about 2,000 years later. And yet, Jesus still appeals to the heart and to the head. And here you are. Here we are. And in the midst of the trials and difficulties and challenges and grief we often have, he still gives us that possibility of rejoicing with an indescribable and glorious joy because of who he is, what he's done, and what is coming. You have not seen him. You do not see him now, but you will see him and rejoice.